Thank you. Yeah, and thank you very much for the opportunity to be here and to give a talk. So as Marco was saying, I'm going to tell you a little bit about a way to produce black holes in axion models. And so this is some recent work done with Marius Kongsor at NYU. And I guess before kind of getting into the details, I just want to give you just a little overview about the main idea of the project and some motivation for this. Right, so first, why axions? We'll say axions are one of the most well-motivated particles and beyond the standard model for probably two main reasons. The first is that the QCD axion can solve the strong CP problem, right, which is the unexpected smallness of the neutron electric dipole moment. Another very nice feature of axions, not just the QCD axion, is that they can be easily produced in the early universe. And it could be an excellent dark matter candidate being produced via the typical misalignment mechanism or from cosmic strings decay and domain wall decay. Now, in the kind of standard cosmological lore, when the universe reaches a very high temperature, far above the axion decay constant scale FA, then as the universe expanded and cooled, as the temperature dropped below the scale FA, then axion strings formed. Where these are strings such that as you go around in physical space, the axion field varies from 0 to 2 pi as one makes a loop around the string. Now, these strings, roughly regardless of their initial conditions, will reach this attractor solution known as scaling, where the typical size and the separation of the strings are going to be roughly the horizon size due to self-intercommutation and emission of gravitational waves and axions. Now, these strings will maintain roughly this one per horizon, roughly until the QCD phase transition at TQCD. At this time, something special can happen, and that every axion string becomes attached to a domain wall. Kind of have this membrane-like pattern here. And very quickly, these domain walls will pull on these strings and cause the whole network to decay and emit axions exactly like this animation showed. So that today, there will be axion dark matter. All right, that's kind of the standard picture. Now, what I want to emphasize, the kind of the key thing for this talk, is that there can be additional interesting features in these axion models. And that, while I said every axion string becomes attached to the domain wall, it's possible, though very rare, to find parts of the universe where there's an enclosed axion domain wall that's not attached to any string. And what's very special about these walls is that it's energetically favorable for them to contract, converting their rest mass into kinetic energy. And they shrink to a very small size, bringing this large amount of energy with them. And potentially, they can contract to a size of order the Schwarzschild radius and form a black hole. So that today, there is both axion dark matter from the standard production mechanisms, as well as some subdominant component of black holes formed from these collapsing enclosed domain walls. So that's kind of the gist of this talk. And what I want to do is, in particular, go now in detail about this idea. So what I'm going to first do is I'm going to talk about this cosmology and the formation of these axion defects, including the enclosed domain wall densities. And then once we figure out the density and the size distribution of these enclosed walls, what I want to do is I want to focus on a single enclosed wall and look at the dynamics of it, how it collapses, and how it can potentially collapse within a Schwarzschild radius to form a black hole. We're going to combine the efficiency of forming this, or going to combine the dynamics of the wall with the number density to then estimate the efficiency of PBH formation, and finally the relic abundance to see the abundance of PBHs for axion models. Now, what's going to happen is that you're going to need generally very large FA for a relatively large abundance of black holes to form. For the QCD axion, it's going to be a little bit tricky because there's some cosmological bounds that FA can't be too large. I'll show you the details at the end. But for ALPS, this formalism that I'm going to tell you about applies basically exactly the same way. And there is no cosmological bound in the same way in that you can have a little bit larger abundance in ALP models. Okay. So let's go ahead and talk about the cosmology and these formation of really topological defects. Okay, so really the formation of topological defects can be understood really by what the symmetries of your model are at different points in time. So in the UV at very high temperatures, the relevant axion physics are described by this complex scalar field phi with a Lagrangian that respects some U1 symmetry. Now, as the temperature of the universe cools below the minimum of this potential, which is going to be FA, then this phi field develops a vacuum expectation value of order FA, where the axion is going to be the angular degree of freedom of this complex scalar field, right? And this is just a, in orange, is just showing a wine bottle potential, showing a U1 symmetric potential, where the axion field, or this phi field, at high temperatures is unbroken, and then at FA, temperatures below FA, one of these minima are going to occur. That is, the axion field, or this phi, will go into one of these minima in the brim of this potential. Okay, so how does this manifest itself in the universe? Okay, well, let's look here. So let's look at this U1 potential, just kind of a bird's eye view. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to split it up into three separate regions, following a manner due to Sakivi, which is basically just the Kibble mechanism. This is what's going to follow. So at different parts of the universe are going to fall into different random vacua. I don't know which one it's going to fall into, right? The minima of this potential is the new ground state of our universe here. And different parts of the universe are going to fall into, say, here. Some are going to be there. Some are going to be there. It's going to be totally random. Okay, so what happens? Well, let's kind of mimic this procedure. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to take my universe and look at a kind of a cross-sectional slice shown here. Right, and each patch or each square here is going to represent the size where the axion field is roughly in that minima. So this is the region of my correlated domains. So at minimum, it's at least each horizon size you can think of, though it can potentially be less if the correlation length of my axion field is smaller. But basically, each of these patches represent a cross-sectional slice where my axion field happened to go into, that random minimum. I guess it's good I didn't use this side. No dangerous ice skates there. So let's just take our cross-sectional slice of the universe and just put random values of theta 1, theta 2, theta 3, corresponding to whether, if it's in theta 1, that means the axion field is somewhere between, say, 0 and pi over 3, or 2 pi over 3. Theta 2 means the axion field value, the new minima, is somewhere between 2 pi over 3 and 5 pi over 3, et cetera. Okay? Now, there's going to be special configurations shown here and here, where my, in physical space, as I go around, so I have theta 1, theta 2, theta 2, theta 3, what actually happens in physical space is that my minima are traversing in this field value going from 0 back to 2 pi, okay? And you can see here, in this case, I have kind of this right-hand rule demonstration where into the board, I wind like this. Whereas in this part of the universe, I have the opposite winding, where I have theta 1, theta 2, theta 3 going like this in this configuration. So I go clockwise or counterclockwise in these particular points in space. Now, what's very interesting is that if I were to do this at different cross-sectional slices, like in 3D, which you actually need to do, of course, is that my thumb, say it points here, it actually can never end without going back on itself or going into infinity. Okay, so this is a winding number, effectively, what I'm representing. And what my thumb is pointing to is actually the cosmic string. Okay, so what one can show is that there are field solutions where as I go around in physical space by 2 pi, I'm going around this vacuum from 0 to 2 pi. And as you get closer and closer to this vertex, what you're doing is in physical space, you're going closer and closer to the peak of this potential. Right, and that potential has a lot of energy density. So where my thumb was pointing, which I said can never go back, can never end, it has to go back on itself or go into infinity, is basically a string, a locus of points, a line like a collection of points that has a lot of energy density, where in physical space, I'm located at this point where my symmetry remains unbroken. I have a lot of energy density. So these are cosmic strings. And again, this blue circle corresponds to a string going into or going towards us. This arrow going that way corresponds to a string going into the board, all right? So to remember, this spontaneous breaking of this U1 symmetry generally will give you cosmic strings. And these strings are the locus of points in physical space where my phi field remains unbroken, where I'm on the top of that minimum, okay? And as I go around this string in physical space, my axion field, which before basically what I was calling theta, varies A over FA from 0 to 2 pi. Now, there's one more thing I want to go by with you guys before moving on. And one particular interesting quantity about strings are what's called their string tension, which will be very useful for us. And now I said this had a large, this string was really just the locus of points where my phi field remains unbroken. It's a lot of energy density where the, in physical space where those where that string is located. And this string has a given mass per unit length, which is just gonna be given by the energy density where the string is located, that is where phi equals zero, where my symmetry is unbroken, times typically the cross-sectional slice of the string. Okay, so what is this? Well, my energy density where my string is located is gonna be of order the symmetry breaking scale to the fourth power, right? That's just my potential. What is the thickness of the string? Well, it's gonna be set by roughly the inverse mass of the heavy field that now, this heavy phi field, the radial mode, and that's gonna be 1 over MA, and I square it because I'm looking at a cross-sectional slice. You can see parametrically, this mass per unit length is gonna be something of order FA squared. And indeed, you can calculate this a little bit more exactly, and what you find that is roughly FA squared times this log factor, which is a special consequence of global strings. Okay. Now,
where does the log factor come from?
Yeah, so for global strings, so you actually have to integrate the energy density over some area, right? And what you'll find for global strings is that you'll have like a 1 over r dr, and it diverges. Oh. And so you, that's a log factor, and it's cut off by basically where the other strings are, and that's of order L. So that's where parametrically it comes from.
And we are talking about globalist strings?
Yeah, axions are global strings. So for gauge strings, which this still will follow, you don't necessarily have this log factor, because there's heavy radial mode as well. Good. Now, how do these strings evolve? Well, when I create my strings, eventually we'll reach the scaling solution I mentioned, which is this attractor solution where there's roughly one string per horizon. And you can think about that qualitatively about what's happening is, remember, I have my strings, which, as I said, pointed with my thumb, they can either go back on themselves, forming a loop, or they can just go off to infinity, which is called the infinite string. And this string will just vary randomly from horizon to horizon, and that's shown by this curvature here. So initially, I'll have some string where this red is the horizon at that point in time. And as the universe evolves, this horizon will grow. And my string inside the horizon, those perturbations on scales smaller than the horizon are free to move, while perturbations outside the horizon, causality, they just can't move yet. So this the strings inside this horizon scale structure smaller than the horizon will be able to oscillate, and they can emit gravitons, axions, they can intercommute, et cetera, and they'll reduce their curvature, and roughly they'll maintain roughly this one curvature per horizon, which is this one string per horizon with time. So you can see as the horizon grows, my small scale structure will be damped, and I'll always maintain that one string per horizon. So that's qualitatively what kind of scaling is, and this will happen from a little bit after when the strings form at temperature of FA all the way to the QCD phase transition. At the QCD phase transition, we get some new interesting dynamics happening. In particular, our axion now has another effective symmetry. We have this new potential, this famous cosine potential, where the axion field lies. We can see there are different minima at cosine of A over FA, 0, 2 pi, etc. So again, this happens, this potential becomes important near the QCD phase transition, where this axion mass grows, and this term, this potential at the axion field can be very large. Now you can see what will happen is that at my minima, where A over FA, which I'm gonna calling theta, is zero, and 2 pi, I have various minima. But you have to cross from A, when A over FA is pi, this potential will actually be large, right? So it's minimized at A over FA is 0 and 2 pi, but then at A over FA equals pi, I have some bump in my potential. So wherever my axion field takes a value of pi, I have a large amount of energy density. And that little bump in energy density, just like for the strings, is indicative of a large concentration of energy density. That is what's going to be a domain wall, okay? And this domain wall, instead of a string, it's actually a surface-like effect, okay? Where the domain wall is in particular, it's the field configuration that interpolates from one vacuum at theta equals zero, theta equals A over FA equals zero, back to my other vacuum, my same vacuum at theta equals two pi. So when my axion field traverses from 0 to 2 pi, I have to go over a bump in my energy density at theta equals pi. And that is a large concentration of energy. That is my domain wall, okay, shown kind of by this red value here, okay, where I have a large concentration of energy. All right? Now, this domain wall will be connected to every string. And the reason is because, right, my domain wall is where I have theta equals pi. It's a surface where theta equals pi. And remember, my string, as I go around the string, it varies from 0 to 2 pi. So that means I have to cross a surface of constant theta equals pi, meaning that every string becomes attached to a domain wall. There's a large concentration of energy density here now in the axion field at theta equals pi. So every string kind of has like a membrane emanating out of it, which is a domain wall, okay? So again, the key thing is that my domain wall is where my surface, my axion field, takes a value of pi. That's where there's a large concentration of energy density in the axion field value. One more kind of macroscopic quantity that we're going to be needing is the mass per area of these domain walls, which we can estimate parametrically very similarly to how we did it for strings. So roughly speaking, this mass per unit area called sigma, the surface tension, is going to be my energy density where my axion field is located, or where my domain wall is located, which is at theta equals pi, times the thickness of my membrane. Okay? My potential at theta equals pi, you can just read off from here, is going to be something like ma squared fa squared. And the thickness is going to be set by the inverse curvature of this potential, which is going to be just the inverse axion mass. So parametrically, what you expect is that the sigma is going to be something like ma squared fa squared times 1 over ma. And indeed, if you do it a little bit more correctly, you'll find that it's roughly 8 times ma fa squared. So a key thing to remember is the larger my axion field decay constant is, fa, the larger my mass per unit area is, which is going to make it easier to form black holes, because if my black holes or my domain walls are of a given fixed size, say of order of the horizon, for a given FA, I'm going to have much more mass because my mass per area is much larger for a large FA than it is for a small FA. Okay? So we're going to come back to that. All right. Now, what I've shown you so far is that how every axion string becomes attached to a domain wall. The question is now, where are these enclosed walls that I was telling you? How do they form, and what is their abundance? Okay. Well, remember, let's look at, for example, my minima, my new circle, or my circle of minima for my axion field, which are where the rim of that potential, that U1 potential. So it takes values between 0 and 2 pi. So here is just looking at a kind of a bird's eye view of that potential. And if I have, for example, a string going into the board, I know that my field value varies from 0 to 2 pi as I go around the string. And at theta equals pi, I have a surface of a domain wall emanating out from it. So here I have like a string into the board. What I'm going to do again, very similar to how I did before with the string, is I'm going to look at a cross-sectional slice of my universe. I'm going to put random values of theta corresponding to where the potential, the minima of my axion field can vary at different parts of the universe near the QCD phase transition. So different parts of my universe are going to fall into various random values between theta equals 0 and 2 pi, okay? So in this part, for example, this cross-sectional slice of my universe and this like horizon, my axion field value takes some value between, in this region theta 2, somewhere between pi over 3 and 5 pi over 3. And this part of the universe, the typical value of my axion field is in theta 1, somewhere between pi and pi over 3, et cetera, okay? So it's just totally random process. Now the question is, do you see the axion strings? Do you see the axion walls? Here, let's look at them, okay? Well, we know for the axion strings that I have an axion string going into or out of the board whenever I wind from 0 to 2 pi around this string in physical space, or around, when I go, my axion field varies from 0 to 2 pi in physical space, I have a string going into or out of the board at the center. So for example, here, in this random part of the universe, I have theta 1, theta 2, theta 3, back to theta 1. So I'm literally going around this value in field space, in physical space. So I have to have an axion string going into the board at that shared vertex. Likewise, I go the opposite winding, and I have a string going towards us in that part of the universe. Okay, so here is just my random strings, and you can see there's going to be roughly one per horizon just by random chance. Okay, where are the domain walls? Well, I know I have a domain wall whenever my axion field takes a value of pi, okay? So whenever I have a go from a region from theta 1 to theta 3, the axion field is continuous. I have to go across pi. So what you can see is in this case. Here, for example, I have a theta 1 and theta 3. And so I have a domain wall. This is, again, a cross-sectional slice. The string is going into the board here and out of the board there. I have a domain wall that's like a membrane that separates the two, or that is connected to the string. And indeed, you can see that every string shown by the circles is connected to a domain wall shown by this red slice. Again, this is a cross-sectional slice of my universe. But by chance, you can find some parts of the universe where I happen to be in a special location where I have just theta 1 inside and surrounded entirely by theta 3 or vice versa. So again, this is my axion field is continuous. I have to cross a surface of constant theta equals pi here. And this is a special case where I go from 0 to pi, or excuse me, I cross pi, and it's in totally enclosed surface. So this is
a little bit lost. Can you go back to a geom that you the potential, you have both U1 and Z2 different locations of the potential?
Yeah, sorry, go back here or the previous?
How do I have like both U1 symmetry and Z2 symmetry for these both of the days of the manifold?
Right, so the I have this, so first my U1 symmetry is coming from this wine bottle-like potential, right? So I have my axion field value, which is the angular degree of freedom. I guess, can you see my mouse?
Like yeah. A.
Exactly, it's my axion field. It's the angular degree of freedom. It lives in this rim of this potential, right? Okay, and different parts of my universe are gonna be in different random values of theta, of A over FA, okay? Then near the QCD phase transition, my axion field gets a new potential because this, from strong dynamics, this mass of my axion field, which is very small, which is basically zero at high temperatures, it grows as my temperature goes closer to TQCD. And so I have this new potential, okay, in my axion field. So the rim of this wine bottle potential has this cosine-like now hills that develop, right? So now my axion field has a potential to go to a minima at theta equals zero or equivalently to pi, right?
Some regions, it's still in U1 in the other
region. The U1 is broken.
Right, so exactly, the QCD breaks this U1-PQ symmetry, right? And so my axion field wants to go to a new minima at theta equals zero or pi, or theta equals two pi, which are equivalent, right? But at theta equals pi, like my minima goes through a little hill. So like if I have my wine bottle potential shown here, right, what if you go between zero and two pi, I've got now a new, like this rim, which is not flat anymore, has a little mountain, kind of like this.
Just tilt the wine bottle.
You tilt it if you want to think about it like that. And so my axion field wants to go into this new minima, right? But whenever I have an axion field that happened to be at theta equals pi, which I did right before my U1 was broken, that means that my axion field just has a large amount of energy density there. And that is the surface of my domain wall.
But then you're saying that strings that were produced before the phase transition, they don't decay or anything?
Well, my string represents, in physical space, as I go around the string in physical space, I have to wind around this rim of this wine bottle potential. And so that, since you go around, as in physical space, as I go around my string, I have to cross my surface where I have this extra energy density. That's where my domain wall is. So since I go around my axion, my domain wall is wherever I have my axion field takes a value of pi, roughly speaking. So since for my every axion string, as I go between zero and two pi, I have to cross the surface of theta equals pi, right? That's as I go around here. And that's like a shark fin emanating from the string. And that's a surface of large energy density. That's the domain wall.
That's why they cannot break.
That's why they cannot what?
They cannot break, or they don't decay. Like
let's say. Yeah, well, the walls will pull on the strings, and the whole network will emit axions and eventually decay. Yeah, my little graphic at the beginning that was not exactly as good as the simulations of Malta and company, but close enough. Right. Okay. Any other questions? Right, so what we're trying to do is, what I was just showing here was that every axion string becomes attached to a domain wall, because again, as I go around the circle, I have to cross the surface of constant theta equals pi where my domain wall is located, where I have a large concentration of energy density. But just by chance, if I look at my universe, I'll have some regions where I happen to have values of theta 1, meaning my axion field takes some random value between pi and pi over 3, And to the adjacent to it, another patch in the universe, I'll have my axion field is some random value between pi and 5 pi over 3. But the axion field is continuous, so I have to cross a surface of constant theta equals pi between these two patches of my universe, which means that I have a large amount of energy density. That's my domain wall. Okay? So the point is that I can get very rare regions of space where my axion field is entirely, or I have a region of an enclosed surface of constant theta equals pi. That's an enclosed domain wall. Okay? And you can see this is literally just geometry. There's no physics really into this. This is just random chance. And you can see that this is a rare process. In fact, there's nothing stopping me from even getting a larger region that's just theta 1 surrounded by theta 3, right? But it's going to be rare. So in fact, there's going to be some size distribution of these enclosed walls, right? And they're going to be rare and rare the bigger they are, just because geometrically it's less likely to have a region of space where my axion field is theta 1 surrounded entirely by a region, my axion field is 0 surrounded by a region of 2 pi or vice versa. Okay, right. So again, each of these cross-sectional slices roughly represent a horizon. And what we can do is we can effectively do this on this lattice. We can put random values of theta 1, theta 2, theta 3, corresponding to whether the axion field happens to be in this region, or this region. And we can just count how rare are these enclosed walls where I have a region of theta 1 surrounded by theta 3 or vice versa, and what their size distribution is. And what you'll find is you find an exponential distribution, and these are less and less likely the bigger the walls are. That is, the more lattice sites they are, which roughly corresponds to a given horizon volume. So here we just did a bunch of random Monte Carlo simulations where you literally just take a 3D lattice and put theta 1, theta 2, theta 3 in randomly, and you just find the boxes that are theta 1 surrounded by theta 3. That is, I have some constant surface of theta equals pi surrounding some box. And so you'll find roughly that 1 per 1,000 horizons, or 1 per 1,000 of these boxes, you'll find an enclosed wall. That's roughly horizon volume. Okay. Now you can find larger walls that are 2 boxes, 2 horizon volumes, 3 horizon volumes, 4 horizon volumes, etc. But they're going to be rare. In fact, this process is called percolation theory, and there's some ansatzes for how you expect these cluster sizes to grow. And indeed, they follow some exponential distribution, which we can fit for. And it goes roughly as a volume to the minus 2/3 power, meaning that if the radius is of order, the volume is of order the radius cubed, these guys go as e roughly to the minus r squared, where r is the typical size of my domain wall. Okay. Now, a few comments are in order. So first is that you find, at minimum, you get roughly one of these enclosed walls per 1,000 correlation volumes or horizons. So this is one reason why these aren't really seen in simulations, because most of these very intense simulations are only simulating a couple of horizons, just because computationally it's not feasible to simulate many horizons. So this is why these big enclosed walls have not been seen in these more intense simulations. The second thing that's important, again, is the size distribution, which will be important because these guys can be super horizon. And as I'll talk about shortly, is that these super horizon walls can actually grow with the expansion of the universe, and you get free energy out of them, which increases their mass, making it more easy to form a black hole, because their Schwarzschild radius will grow. Okay, so once the horizon re-enters, these walls will collapse, and they'll form potentially a PBH, which is what I'll talk about shortly. Now, this method, which is I said earlier, Sakivi, which is basically the Kibble mechanism, is a somewhat of a coarse grained version of the actual axion field. It's basically a discretized version where I'm saying my axion field is correlated, entirely correlated, on positions less than a horizon volume, or horizon size L, and it's entirely uncorrelated on distances greater than my horizon, roughly L. Okay? But again, the axion field is not discontinuous like this. It's actually a continuous field. And what we can do is we can kind of do a continuous version of this algorithm by generating a random field. It takes values between 0 and 2 pi with some given correlation length. Now, computationally, it's a little bit easier to mimic that box-like function with some Gaussian-like exponential. So what I want to do is I basically want to create a random field, a continuous random field, to mimic this random axion field when my axion will near the QCD phase transition. And it will have some correlation that's extremely correlated on distances much less than the horizon, and very uncorrelated, totally random, on distances much greater than the horizon. Because it's just by chance, you're going to get random values. Yeah, Nyash.
What is the correct thing, actually? I mean, you're just inventing a Gaussian, but what is the actual correlation?
Right, I don't know. It's just going to be statistically, I want some function that's very correlated at distances smaller than the horizon, or some arbitrary scale L.
This would be some inflationary calculation, should be what the right correlation is, isn't it?
Well, no, it's set by the scaling network of the strings, right? The strings tell you that the axon field is correlated on distances less than L. There's string separation and entirely uncorrelated on distances.
It comes out of the string.
Exactly. You fix it by the strings, which, because they reach scaling, that tells you what the correlation of the axon field is at a given point in time, right?
Like the locations where you have the walls are exactly the locations you don't have strings to start with.
The location of the wall... Not necessarily. Like, these strings will, like, when you first create the strings early near, you know, the peaky phase transition, you're going to have different small patches of the universe. The axion field will be some random value here and there. But those strings will intercommute and intersect, and those values of theta will get refreshed or be randomized at different points after, because of the scaling, right? Because my correlation length has to grow. So in early times, I have many different axion field values in a given space. Because of scaling and intercommutation, the axion field will now be correlated over a larger region. And so it gets refreshed, basically, how the randomness of the axion field every Hubble time, roughly. Yeah. Right.
In the simulations, are you treating the gravity as just, is these are spectator or linear theory, or?
Gravity. So I'm not discussing gravity at all yet. Gravity can potentially become important when you're talking about forming a black hole, because you're dealing with very large energies in a small volume. But one can show that the gravity is a subdominant effect for anything I'm going to be talking about.
Horizon or something. It is like a spectator on the
FRW. Oh yeah, I just mean the horizon size. Like this, right? These boxes basically represent the correlation of the axion field. So it's an arbitrary scale. Like, this is just geometry. I haven't told you any physics. The physics enters because the strings maintain a scaling solution, which tells you the size of my correlated domains of my axion field at a given point in time, right? So the roughly, because of scaling, my axion field is correlated within a size of order t. And that's just what I mean by that. Yeah, by the horizon. Right. Okay. All right. So the point is, we have statistically, we don't know anything in particular, but we can get statistical descriptions of how rare these enclosed walls are by generating some random continuous field that's very correlated on scales much smaller than some arbitrary scale L, and much greater than, which is a string scale, order of the horizon. And it's entirely uncorrelated, or very uncorrelated, on scales much larger than the string separation L. Okay, and what we can do is you can generate a continuous random field. And what's shown here is a surface of constant theta of a continuous random field that can vary between 0 and 2 pi. And the axes are in units, arbitrary units of this length scale L. Okay, so the physics of scaling tells you how to identify L to a physical scale. It's of order t, right? Okay, and what you can see is that on distances much greater than L, this field, which looks like some coral reef-like pattern, it's entirely random, it's Brownian-like, okay? That just tells you, because my field is heavily uncorrelated on distances less than L, it's very random, okay?
So,
yeah?
Shouldn't something be periodic about this? Because, I mean, it looks like the theta and theta plus 2 pi are different things, and I don't really know. Yeah, because if you just generate random Gaussian fields,
This is a phase of a random, the phase of a Gaussian, random Gaussian field is a uniform random field. And so I'm taking the phase of a Gaussian field, a random Gaussian field.
Okay.
So it's periodic in 0 to 2 pi, and I'm just looking at some constant surface, theta equals pi, and that's as a domain wall. This is what the domain walls are. So this is an infinite domain wall network, right? And it's these random Brownian-like surfaces on distances much greater than this length scale L, and much and non-Brownian on distances much less than L.
But you see, there's something kind of not right about doing it like this, because a statement about, if you say random Gaussian field, you're making a statement about the probability distribution. You're saying the probability distribution is a Gaussian with this correlation function, right?
Yeah. So I'm taking an arbitrary correlation function that I want something that's just correlated on distances less than some length scale, and highly uncorrelated on distances greater than the length scale. Right.
I understand that. That's a statement of a correlation function. But you do more than that. You assume it's a random Gaussian field as well.
No. What I want to generate a uniform random field, right? Because that's what mimics the axion. The axion is supposed to be randomly picked from 0 to 2 pi in different points of my horizon, different points of my universe, right?
Yeah.
Near the QCD phase transition. So I want to generate a uniform random field. And to do that, I can generate, just computationally, it's easier to generate a random Gaussian field with a given correlation and take the phase of that to get a uniform random field with that given correlation. So I'm generating a uniform random field, which is supposed to mimic that pointing that theta 1, theta 2, theta 3 are uniformly chosen, right? That mimic, right, between 0 and 2 pi, right? And what you'll find is, right, so here's this infinite walled network with these membranes. And what I can do is, you don't see any enclosed walls at the moment, but I can basically shave off this box, and we can look inside it. And what you'll find is that, by chance, I've got these two little nice surfaces are enclosed, are not part of this infinite wall membrane network. And these are my enclosed walls, okay? And what you can do is, you can repeat this simulation many, many times and get statistics on how rare these enclosed walls are. Right, how many per horizon you get and what their size distribution are. And what you'll find is exactly as we found before from this discrete simulation, is that you get roughly one enclosed wall, one of these golden nuggets, per 1,000 of these correlation volumes. So roughly every 10 by 10 by 10 box of each L represents roughly the string separation or horizon, you'll find one of these enclosed walls, okay? And not only that, is that I said we can get a distribution of sizes. And as predicted before by this discrete percolation theory result, is that you expect the number distribution of these in size to go as e to the minus r squared. And indeed, here's just a plot showing the typical radius of these strings in units of this length L versus how many we found from running many, many of these simulations, is that they do follow this nice e to the minus r squared distribution expected from percolation theory. Okay. On top of that, you can get information about the typical size of these walls, or how their shapes, I should say. And before, I was saying these walls maybe look like they're some box-like behavior in this discrete simulation. Of course, they're not box-like, and they're not perfectly spherical either. And this is going to be important for understanding the efficiency of PBH formation. So what we find is that roughly these walls have a typical max and mean centroid distance, not equal to one, meaning that they're a little bit longer than they are wider in their semi-major axis, and they have some non-zero semi-minor axis as well. So the key thing to note is that these walls are not perfectly spherical, which is going to become important for considering whether these walls can collapse and form a PBH. Because if you don't have a perfectly spherical wall, as it shrinks, it's not going to be able to stuff enough energy in a given volume and form a PBH. That is, to form stuff enough energy within a Schwarzschild radius. Okay, so I guess I have 15 minutes?
A bit more than that.
Okay. Sorry, sit.
20.
Okay. So let me talk about the last parts. We've understood the number density of these enclosed walls. They roughly start off as 1 per 1,000 horizons, and there's a distribution of sizes that can be greater than the horizon. Okay, we're going to take this, and we're going to look at now isolated enclosed walls and see how they behave in the universe. Okay, so imagine I have an enclosed wall of a given radius I'm going to call R naught, which is some fraction of my horizon T, some fraction alpha of the horizon. And this is, again, will be sampled from that random from that distribution, that exponential distribution of enclosed walls. So here I show the wall in red, and the horizon is shown in this dashed black circle. Now, because the wall is super horizon, what happens is that it will actually expand with the expansion of the universe, expands with the scale factor. One can show numerically or analytically, so that its radius as a function of time will grow with a scale factor after formation. So it gets stretched, and you get free energy basically out of this, because remember, my wall has a constant mass per area, or has a given mass per area. And if my area grows, now I have a larger mass. So you get energy from, or mass, from these, from the growth of these superhorizon walls after formation, from the stretching of the expansion of the universe. Now, because the walls will stretch with the scale factor as A, which say goes as T to the 1/2 or T to the 2/3, depending on whether you're in a radiation or matter dominated era, whereas the horizon grows as time, that means the horizon will always grow faster than the scale factor, and the horizon will eventually catch up to the wall. And at that point, the wall now becomes subhorizon, and it is free to collapse, okay? And it can then potentially form a PBH as it relativistically collapses towards its center. Now, depending on how the scale factor grows with time, in a radiation era or a matter-dominated era, you can get an extra factor of enhancement from the stretching, depending on whether you're in a radiation or matter-dominated era. Now, because the matter-dominated era scales as T to the 2/3, time to the 2/3, you get a larger, the wall can stretch more before the horizon will catch up to it. So if I start off with a wall that's roughly alpha times the horizon size, it will be alpha squared times the original size by the time the horizon re-enters, or the wall re-enters the horizon, and it collapses. So this number right here, this alpha, is what's related to that exponential distribution of walls. And so you can correlate, or you can match a given number density to a given initial size or a given final size at horizon reentry, i.e. you can determine the mass of the domain wall at horizon reentry. Okay? So this wall, once it reenters, will quickly collapse very soon after it reenters at near the speed of light. So let's talk about this collapse part. Okay, so what happens to the wall? We want to see in reality whether we can stuff enough energy into a given volume of a Schwarzschild radius to see whether we can form a black hole. Now, what you may expect is that you can use what's called this Nambu-Goto picture, which is an effective theory for how these walls behave. It's basically saying that the walls are infinitely thin, and I have some given initial energy, which is, if it's roughly spherical, 4 pi times my mass per area times my area at reentry squared, my area at reentry. Now, this energy will get converted to kinetic energy. So if I have a very thin shell, as it collapses and it has some given radius r, it's going to be relativistically moving. So it has some Lorentz factor gamma as it shrinks. And that's just shown by this equation here. And if you use energy conservation, what you'll find is that this Lorentz factor gamma is equal to my initial size of my wall at radius at reentry divided by my radius. And so you can see this Lorentz factor will become huge very quickly as my radius shrinks. Now, this is what you expect, and it's called this Nambu-Goto picture, this thin wall limit. But the reality is the walls are not perfectly thin. They have some thickness set by roughly the mass of the inverse mass of the axion, as we discussed before. And you have to use actually the thick wall limit. We're actually solving the equation of motion, the Stein-Gordon equation for the dynamics of the wall. And you need to do this to capture these thick wall effects, which prevent this axion domain wall from collapsing all the way to a single point, which you would naively expect in an infinitely thin wall limit. And you need it to also calculate to see how axion radiation is important for these dynamics. Okay, so this is what we...
Baryon friction?
Sorry.
Friction from baryons?
Generally no. So for the friction, you typically need the momentum of your particle to be very slow so that its wavelength is large enough to reflect off. And really the only background particles that have that are background non-relativistic axions from misalignment and itself. And it's a so
neutrons. They are still too.
Those are still, they have to be non-relativistic on this, they have to have a momentum of order the mass of the axion. So it's extremely small.
Because like when they climb to somewhere like where theta equal to pi, right? When they want to exit, they need to climb all the way to theta equal to pi. And at that point, like I think your mass becomes heavier or lighter.
Right, so, as far as I know, Talking with Sakivi and others is that the most important effect is still from axions just because of the momentum. The momentum dependence is important too. If the momentum is very small, then it won't really see the wall and it just kind of goes right through. So you have to calculate these like reflection and transmission coefficients. And these background particles crossing this barrier of the wall. And it's very momentum dependent. So as far as I know, really only the axions, background non-relativistic axions, give the dominant force of friction, and it's small at this temperature.
Yeah, the other question I have is here, like, are you going to solve like a MAT, like a before like the mass term, or?
Yeah. So the nice thing about once this is sub-horizon, so I don't have Hubble here, right? Because it's small at this point, which is nice. So what you can do is you can solve this numerically by changing variables such that your distance variable is 1/MA, and you can have that be a temperature or time dependent. And so we can solve this regardless for a time dependent temperature or mass or not. So what's going to enter is going to be the units of importance for distance are the instantaneous inverse axion mass. So so the results that we talk about, I'm going to tell you about, are going to be true whether it's time dependent time dependent thickness or not. So we take this into account.
So what is the initial condition? So how can start?
I'll show you in a sec on the next slide.
So one last question. So what about deviation from a spherical symmetry?
Yeah. So I'm going to talk about that next, or maybe I'll briefly get to it. Yeah. So it helps to understand the spherical case first before understanding the ellipsoidal case. Right, because as I said, the walls are not perfectly spherical, which is important for collapse. Right, so Daniel, to answer your question, so here's a plot showing how these axion walls collapse. This is again for a perfectly spherical wall, but I'll tell you how it changes over asphericities. So right, remember the axion domain wall is a field valid configuration that interpolates from 0 to 2 pi, and it goes through pi, right? So I have my axion field profile that looks something like this. You can just solve this analytically from the Sine-Gordon equation, right? This is just the asymptotic value for a quasi-planar wall, right? So interpolates from 0 to 2 pi. The bottom panel in orange shows the energy density in my field. So you can see it's roughly zero. Then I have a large change in my axion field value and then no change. So I have a large concentration, this Gaussian-like peak in energy density, which is my domain wall. Okay, so this is my initial condition. So I have some field profile that looks like this. I will talk about how those have changed things. So first, this is just a perfectly spherical wall. You can have a random velocity field, for example, where there's some random motion, and that will correspond to some initial angular momentum. And the point I'll just say it very briefly at the end, but the angular momentum will only prevent PBH formation for walls that are FA is just too small anyway to be of importance. So it helps. I just want to go over just the dynamics of an ideal case first before adding on these extra layers. Yeah. Right. So we have some initial wall profile that looks something like this, interpolates between 0 and 2 pi. The x-axis is just the radius of the wall and units of its thickness. So its Gaussian peak is of order of the inverse axion mass, 1/delta. Okay. Now what happens as we let it go? It starts from rest and it's going to shrink. And here it shrinks, as you can see, by the Gaussian energy profile. It goes to r equals zero. It's accelerating there towards the center. And you can see some interesting effects happening. Is at first, if you notice, the thickness of the wall actually has shrunk. And the reason is because my axion is actually the thickness is Lorentz contracted, okay? So this is an important effect because the actual Lorentz contracted mass of the axion field tells you how much you can basically compress these walls, okay? So initially here, the Lorentz factor does follow the Nambu-Goto approximation quite well. It goes as R over R, or R reentry over R squared. And my Lorentz factor grows quite a bit as my wall shrinks towards the center. But you can see what's happening is my Nambu-Goto equation is actually breaking down here. And that the thickness of the wall becomes important, quite soon after it collapses, I'm developing this little horn right here in the axion field. So if I keep rewinding or keep evolving the this domain wall collapsing towards the center, what you'll see is that I get a huge concentration of energy at the very peak of collapse. Roughly the thickness of this is going to be the Lorentz contracted wall thickness, the 1 over the axion mass times this Lorentz factor. And then once it violently collapses, it will partially go through itself. And it emits axions, which are these wiggles that are moving towards the right, emanating away. And the wall will partially go through itself, will expand to a slightly smaller size, smaller because it's lost some of energy from axion emission shown here. And then it will collapse again like a beating lung. And each time it emits more axions and it radiates away and it quickly dies out. So that's kind of the behavior of this for a perfectly spherical wall. And we can ask, or what we actually care about, is how much energy can we compress into a given size? So what we saw before was roughly that you can compress this wall into 1 over its Lorentz contracted wall thickness, where the wall thickness at rest is the inverse axion mass. And what we did is we just ran this simulation for many different sizes to calculate the energy within a given enclosed within a given radius. So the x-axis shows my radius enclosed. So I'm considering how much my fraction of my energy in a given radius. My y-axis just shows that fraction within that radius enclosed. And the different colored contours show my initial wall size. Okay. So as my wall grows in size to begin with, what happens is that I can become more and more Lorentz contracted. And so my wall thins out, which means I can actually compress it to a smaller and smaller size. And so that's what's shown here. As I go to these orange, green, red, and purple contours, the given fraction that I can close within a given radius drops. Roughly speaking, though, it's very hard to get compress the entire energy of my domain wall within a size of order the inverse axion mass, my wall thickness. So this is an important important result you would have to find by solving this equation of motion numerically. If you just use a Nambu-Goto equation, what you would find is that the walls would just be able to contract indefinitely to a small point because you're looking in the infinitely thin wall limit. So the thickness of the wall is very important. Key thing again is that the larger my wall is, the more it can Lorentz contract and the smaller the size it can contract to. For time purposes, I will move on to some of the next topics.
Sorry. Oh. Don't these walls have like currents within them? I mean, strings are conducting, right, or something? Are these walls conducting and do they have currents?
Not as far as I know. So there's just an axion field with some given initial, it's just solving this equation right here. So I'm not taking into account any other effects.
If you have like a constant B field, they are charged.
Yeah.
You need to have some background.
Yeah, the background B field, there's no possible currents.
Right. So that would depend on some primordial magnetic fields, which I don't know the values for, or I don't think anyone really knows. So this is just assuming axion field, no primordial magnetic fields.
Wait, that wasn't a SpongeBob. This is some other character.
it's from SpongeBob. Yeah. I don't remember. It was a flounder or something. So as I was saying, that these perfectly spherical walls are not perfectly spherical, right? This spherical Kao approximation is not actually a good approximation. In reality, these walls have some minor eccentricities, roughly 1.4 times as long as they are their mean radius, and 0.6 times as small in their semi-minor axis compared to their mean radius. So they do have some eccentricities. And the key thing is, how do we model these guys? Well, the large scale asphericities are actually going to be the most important, not so much the small scales, for two main reasons. One is that when these walls form, is that right? The scales or these perturbations on size much less than the horizon can wiggle and emit axions, gravitational waves, etc. And so that's how you maintain scaling, where the typical curvature radius is of order the typical scale of the horizon. But more importantly is actually you can do an analytic estimate for how these modes grow for the collapsing wall as a function of how big they are. And what was been done before for in Nambu-Goto picture is that these small scale asphericities become exponentially damped, whereas the large scale ones grow. So the large scale asphericities are the most important. And so because of this, we can kind of do the next higher order correction for modeling these collapsing domain walls. Instead of a perfectly spherical domain wall, we can estimate it as roughly an ellipsoid to next order. Okay. And so what we did is we also solved these Stein-Gordon equations of motion for given walls with different eccentricities. And we were just seeing how exactly that changes, how much energy we can compress within a given size. And so as expected, on the x-axis here, I have my radius enclosed as a function of my wall thickness. My y-axis is the suppression for an aspherical wall of a given eccentricity compared to a perfectly spherical wall. And what you find is somewhat as expected, and that the more aspherical the wall is, the greater this eccentricity, the more it gets suppressed in how much energy you can compress into a given size. That is, as my wall shrinks, my asphericities grow, and I can't contract enough energy into a given volume. So this is actually quite important for calculating whether you can form a PBH, whether you can stuff enough energy within a given Schwarzschild radius. So what we would do is we simulated various walls and see how this suppression factor changes as a function of how eccentric it is. And we can combine this to figure out, for a given wall of a given eccentricity, what is the probability that it forms a PBH, and combine that with the given size distribution of walls to estimate an omega PBH. So I will just briefly discuss how we actually do this. So from our simulations of collapsing walls, what we actually calculated was the fraction of energy enclosed for a given radius, where this F is equal to the energy within a given radius over my total energy of my system. And I know the total energy of my domain wall. It's going to be roughly equal to its area, or it's equal to its area times its wall tension. Here I just estimating as a perfectly spherical wall, but of course it has some eccentricities. It's not exactly spherical. And its wall tension, as we know of, is proportional to MA and FA squared. The nice thing is we can write this MA as the inverse axion wall inverse wall thickness delta times FA squared. And so that what we want to do is we demand that my energy enclosed within a given radius is less than the Schwarzschild radius of that energy enclosed. That is, I want to demand that my radius enclosed for a given radius, I enclose a given energy. I want to demand that that's less than the Schwarzschild radius, so that I can actually form a PBH, right? And we know what these are. So my energy in a given radius enclosed is equal to my numeric result for the fraction of that energy enclosed times my total energy, which depends on my parameters of my FA squared and my wall thickness. The nice thing about this equation is that when you write this wall tension in terms of the inverse thickness and FA squared, is that what it does is it puts a bound on my radius of reentry over my wall thickness of reentry, independent of my axion mass, because I've written my axion mass is in terms of my wall thickness. So the only physical parameter which tells you whether you can form a PBH is not the absolute magnitude of the axion mass, it's the relative ratio of the mass of the axion to its wall size when it starts to form. And so what this does is allows you to put a bound on my radius of reentry over my initial wall thickness, and to see whether you have enough energy to form a PBH.
If you can wrap so in 5 minutes.
Okay, yeah, I'll be even quicker than that. So let me just wrap up very quickly and say that from the numerically solving the fraction of energy enclosed for a given radius, for a given eccentricities, you can find the minimum size of my wall at horizon reentry to its thickness to form a PBH as a function of the axion decay constant. And what you find is, as expected, for a very large FA, the fraction of how big the wall needs to be to form a PBH is not as large as it is for smaller FA, because for smaller FA, you have to go to a larger geometry to compensate the lower mass that you lose from FA, from the wall tension. Because remember, the wall tension goes as FA squared. For larger, smaller FA, I need to compensate for a larger wall size for the same given energy to make sure my Schwarzschild radius is large enough. And I'll wrap up by saying is that what we can do is we can relate this minimum reentry radius to my wall thickness, which is just depends on my axion model or my initial conditions. I can relate that now to cosmology and to the first the initial abundance of these enclosed walls by just writing out this reentry radius, reentry thickness to reentry radius as a function of my initial condition, my initial enclosed wall properties, which is that exponential distribution of enclosed walls, times my any stretching I get from my superhorizon expansion, times any increase in my axion mass from growth of turn on for my axion mass. As it increases, my wall thickness decreases. So we can relate these now, the left side, this plot, to cosmology and to my initial abundance of enclosed walls. For time, I'm going to skip just angular momentum and show you the final plot, which is showing basically putting all these parameters together. What we can do is we can now infer what a given energy density is in the black holes, which is just the mass of my black hole, which is originated by the progenitor of my domain wall, times my number density of black holes, which is found, which is determined by my number density of my initial wall sizes. And to the number density of my black holes are going to be related to whether my wall is large enough to form a PBH, because it needs to be, for a given FA, I have to be larger than a certain value so that my mass is sufficiently big, such that my Schwarzschild radius is sufficiently large that I can collapse within that given volume. And so what you find is this exponential distribution for my fraction of PBH as a function of FA. This is for the QCD axion. So the blue shows the fraction of the PBH as a function of FA. As expected, you need a very large FA to form a PBH. The mass of the PBHs are of order the solar mass for the QCD axion. Now, what I'll say just very briefly is that, unfortunately for the QCD axion, you cannot just get FA to be a consistent cosmology for a very, very large FA. The reason is because you're simultaneously producing axions from dark matter just from the misalignment mechanism or even from decaying of cosmic strings, and those increase with large FA. So for a sufficiently large FA, you cannot actually, you basically overproduce dark matter and axions, which is obviously in conflict with our cosmology. So unfortunately for the QCD axion at least, it's difficult to get to this very large FA. So in principle, the fraction of PBHs for the QCD axion are gonna be something like likely less than 10 to the minus 10. Now, you don't have this condition from ALPS, which don't need to be diluted as much. So you can have larger FA for ALPS, and you can have a much larger omega PBH for ALPS. And then I'll just wrap up by saying, so what I showed is that cosmologists can generate primordial black holes if you have a very large FA. For the QCD axion, the lensing is out of reach for these next generation telescopes. However, this formalism applies to ALPS too, and potentially those can be determined or those can be seen by next generation telescopes, depending on the mass of the axions of the ALP. However, I just say that what I'm actually most excited about is applying this to non-axion models, because this walls becoming attached to strings are actually quite generic. In for example, grand unified theory, so not necessarily global strings like Niyasha was asking about. In that case, you can have these PBHs form much earlier in the universe, and their mass can be much lighter, potentially right in the interesting mass gap where perhaps all of the PBHs may actually be the dark matter. I apologize for going a little over time, but thank you very much. Thank you.
Some further questions in the room.
But what is a mass distribution of
Oops.
Fixed FA?
Yeah, exactly. So what I just showed was let me make this big again. What I just showed was the peak density. So in reality, at a given FA, you can have larger walls also will form a PBHs. Because they're larger, they have more mass, it's even easier to form a PBH. There's a minimum FA, there's a minimum size of a wall that needs the initial size of the wall to be to form a black hole for a given FA. So these guys are exponentially distributed. So it's like an e to the minus r squared in the size from our simulations of these enclosed walls. So if I were to look at a fixed FA, what I find is that it's peaked at basically the smallest radius of the wall that can form a PBH, and then it's exponentially distributed. And that larger walls, which can also form, form larger mass black holes, but they're exponentially damped. So it would look something like this.
And there are further questions? Questions from Zoom?
I do have one more question. So what about if you have like a string loops that shrink, would that form a black hole?
In principle, yes, but they're very hard to do because you have one less dimension. I mean, you're at a different dimension. So usually these strings will have some impact parameter, and they're going to miss each other. For enclosed surface, you don't really have that as much, right? So some people have estimated this for strings loops, and it's very, very small.
You mean the string loops be this domain wall?
Yeah. So if you can. You can put, right, these string loops will also become attached to domain walls, like a membrane between them near the QCD phase transition. So the same thing will happen. If not, it's even worse, because the domain wall will, if it has some curvature, will move the strings a little bit too in some transverse direction and make the impact parameter potentially even smaller. So, or impact parameter even larger, excuse me. So you can apply that as well for walls. Loops of string attached to a wall, but it's quite hard to do it.
Okay, so these people have tried that it is harder. Okay, it seems to me it must be the same probability, so I don't know. Geometrically, they're similar. So.
Right, well, like normal string loops miss each other, so they can oscillate many, many times, okay. Right?
There is no domain wall in the middle, I can see that, because they just pass each other. But I mean, if there's a domain wall, to shrink to zero area, same way that your spheres want to shrink to zero area. So there's an energetic reason basically to.
Right. Yes and no. If the wall is very flat to begin with, then it can give you extra energy to help pull strings toward the center and potentially form a PBH. But the walls are gonna have some curvature, and so that's gonna cause the strings to. I mean, they have some crazy dynamical pattern, right?
Yep.
Are these guys formed with center of mass velocity?
They will have some arbitrary velocity distribution. So it's going to be sourced by the random axion field which generated them. So you can imagine having in different parts of the universe, the axion field has some arbitrary velocity. Right, which is going to be some relatively large velocity, typically set by the string speed of the infinite string network. And what you can do is you can then put a random velocity on these walls and see how that affects the angular momentum and their potential form to collapse. If they're just moving, if they just have center of mass motion, that doesn't give them any angular momentum.
No, that doesn't make a
right.
Maybe you have like a super fast PBH, even if it's just one.
Right. So in the limit, yeah. So in when the correlation is very large, that is, you have uniform velocity over large space. It's just center of mass motion. There's no angular momentum. When the correlation of the velocity field is very small, you have random velocities, and so they kind of average out, so that the net velocity on the wall, net angular momentum on the wall, is small, right? And so you can you can do this by putting a random velocity field with a given correlation. With this magnitude set by of order the string velocity, which is sourcing the axion field motion. And what you find is that you do have some angular momentum that becomes important preventing collapse of walls, but not for FA smaller than what I'm showing here.
No, but forget about the angular momentum. Just asking, like,
less inversion.
What?
Less inversion.
Yeah, that's what I'm asking. Even we are accounting for the redshift, like.
With
say that these guys are created relativistically early on, so you have the relativistic PBHs floating around. Like,
oh, I see what you're saying.
And then now it's true that it redshifts, but are they still relativistic or are they still fast? Maybe just like, because we usually think of PBHs as something in the halo, right?
Right.
Slowly. But maybe a PBH that is relativistic is easier to see.
I'm not sure. This is like a GB temperature, right? By the time it's a BBN temperature,
Right. Yeah, so I think the typical Lorentz factor that I was showing, you can use that to estimate like the maximum center of mass speed, assuming like that all goes to center of mass motion, right? And for these guys, the Lorentz factor that you get if I recall, in the 10s or 30s, 40s, something like that. So I think it redshifts quite a bit before BBN.
Yeah, right. So I have a very stupid question. So when you tease dust with this gut thing, you said Patti Salam and left right, I guess the other do not support string, the SU5 and SU10, or?
The string walls, right? So for to get walls attached to strings, the symmetry that is associated with the discrete symmetry associated with the wall has to know about the higher symmetry associated with the string. They have to originate from the same symmetry, right? So for the Patti Salam that I discussed, it has to come from SO10. Like there's another, so it is SO10 is the original symmetry, which sources the strings, and then later the Patti Salam is associated with the walls, which is related to the embedded symmetry that it was in. So for SO10, so that is SO10. For the SU5, it's harder to, if I recall, it's harder to find chains which have walls attached to strings. But there probably is one, but I don't know off the top of my head.
Okay.
Yeah.
So if there are no further questions, we can thank the speaker again.
All right. Thank you.